All right, let's dive into this. We've got some really interesting material here. Focusing on a legal case out of Wisconsin, Brunsheimer International, LTD v. Freeland. And this case, you know, really gets into something that's super relevant, I think, especially for law students like yourself who are starting to explore the world of employment law. We're talking about restrictive covenants, those non-compete agreements.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, how this case really brings up all these complex issues about how basic contract law applies in the context of, you know, someone's ongoing employment. Like, how does the idea of consideration work when you're already in a job?
Absolutely. And you're spot on, right? Like, your interest in this, digging into employment law, is what makes this deep dive so important. It's all about giving you a clear understanding of this case and what it all means in practice.
You know, zooming out a bit, this ruling really tries to find that balance, right? Between the need for businesses to protect their interests, like those client relationships and all that confidential stuff, and the employee's right to, well, you know, earn a living and move forward in their career.
Precisely. So what we're trying to do here is break down the core legal principles, the surprising twists in the arguments, and most importantly, what you need to know about how these agreements actually hold up in court, especially when someone's already employed and they're asked to sign one, maybe even with the threat of losing their job. We'll go through the facts, the legal reasoning, and all those little nuances that make this case so interesting.
I think it raises a really basic question for anyone looking at employment contracts. Like, if you're already working somewhere, what's really being exchanged when they ask you to agree to a new restrictive covenant? That's where consideration comes into play, right?
Exactly. Let's start with the backstory. David Friedland, he's working at Brunsheimer, been there for over 15 years. That's a pretty long time. And then in 2009, the company comes along and says, hey, everybody, you got to sign this restrictive covenant.
The interesting thing here is this wasn't part of his original deal when he started working there. This was a new thing they threw at him, you know, way after he'd been there.
Right. And the terms of this agreement were pretty standard. Friedland couldn't work for competitors or try to steal Runsheimer's clients for 2 years after he left. You know, the usual stuff.
They're trying to protect their competitive edge, right? Especially if an employee knows sensitive information or has built relationships with those important clients. Makes sense from their perspective.
But here's where it gets really tricky. They give Friedland just 2 weeks to sign. 2 weeks. And they tell him straight up, if you don't sign, you're fired. So under that kind of pressure, he signs.
That threat of losing his job, that's a big deal. Was he really agreeing to this freely? You have to wonder if there was genuine consent, which is, you know, like contract law 101.
Fast forward a couple of years, Friedland ends up getting fired by Brunsheimer. He then goes and gets a job with a competitor, Corporate Reimbursement Services, or CRS. Brunsheimer's, they're not happy about this, so they sue him, saying he broke the restrictive covenant.
And that's the heart of the legal battle. Brunsheimer wants to enforce this non-compete, and Friedland, while he's saying, hey, I got fired, this shouldn't apply to me.
And you're probably thinking, wait a minute, he was already working there. Why does this new agreement matter? Was it even legal to begin with? It feels like something's missing if he was already a long-term employee.
Exactly. In contracts, you usually have this exchange of value, something both sides bring to the table. If you're already doing your job, what are you getting in return for limiting your future career options?
Which takes us to the main legal issue here, consideration. The big question is, was Runsheimer's promise not to fire Friedland right then and there enough to make him legally bound by the restrictive covenant?
This is so key. Consideration is like the foundation of any contract. If it's not there, the agreement's basically worthless. You know, just a promise without any teeth.
The first court, they sided with Friedland. They said Runsheimer's promise was like empty illusory was the word they used and not real consideration, so the non-compete couldn't be enforced. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court, they disagreed and they reversed the decision.
This back and forth between the lower court and the Supreme Court, it really shows you just how nuanced contract law is, right? Different courts can look at the same facts and legal principles and come to totally different conclusions.
So how do we make sense of this for those of us, you know, trying to wrap our heads around employment law? We've got to understand why the Supreme Court saw things differently.
I think what's really interesting, especially for those studying contract law, is that the Supreme Court was willing to consider something beyond like a direct, obvious benefit to the employee in this case.
Okay, let's break down the Supreme Court's reasoning. So Justice Prosser, he wrote the majority opinion, and he laid out several key reasons for why they thought there was consideration. First up, forbearance as consideration. The court basically said that when an employer chooses not to do something they have the legal right to do, in this case, fire an at-will employee, that choice itself has legal value and can count as consideration.
This is huge, especially in contract law. Forbearance basically means holding back from doing something you could legally do, and it can be a valid form of consideration. In this case, Brunsheimer had the right to fire Friedland whenever they wanted. They didn't have to give him a reason, but they agreed not to fire him right away, and they did that in exchange for him signing that non-compete. The court said that was enough to make it a binding agreement.
The second point they made was about protecting employees from being taken advantage of by their employers. They said that if Brunsheimer had made Friedland sign, and then fired him immediately afterward. Legal principles like fraudulent inducement or this idea of good faith and fair dealing could come in and invalidate the agreement. This is basically a safety net to prevent employers from acting in bad faith. And they even said, quote, "Every contract implies good faith and fair dealing between the parties to it."
That shows that the court was aware of the power imbalance, you know, between employers and employees. So yeah, they said forbearance is valid, but they also acknowledged that there needs to be some way to prevent employers from using this to be unfair or manipulative. Fraudulent inducement, that's a key idea here. If the employer never actually intended to keep the employee on for a reasonable time after getting that signature, the whole non-compete could be thrown out.
Their third point was about preventing employers from finding loopholes. By saying forbearance is valid consideration, they wanted to stop companies from firing people and then immediately rehiring them just to get them to sign a new agreement. It's about making sure employers aren't gaming the system.
This highlights a very practical concern, right? Without this ruling, an employer could fire someone one day, no non-compete involved, and then offer them the same job back the next day, but make signing a non-compete a condition for reemployment. They could argue that the new job itself was the consideration. The court wanted to stop these kinds of sneaky moves from being used to force restrictive covenants on existing employees.
And finally, the court made a point of saying that they were focused on whether consideration existed, not on whether it was, like, enough consideration. They said, quote, "The adequacy, in fact, as distinguished from value in law, is for the parties to judge for themselves." Basically, they're saying they don't care if one side got a better deal than the other, as long as there was some kind of legal consideration exchanged.
That's a fundamental concept in contract law. Courts don't generally get involved in deciding if a deal was fair or if one party got what they consider to be enough value. As long as there was some form of legally recognized consideration, that's enough. The fact that Freeland kept his job for another 2 years after signing, that was sufficient to meet the legal requirement of consideration, regardless of whether he personally thought it was a fair trade-off for the limits placed on his future career.
Now let's shift gears a bit and look at Chief Justice Aberson's concurring opinion. She agreed with the final outcome that the case should go back to the lower court, but she raised some concerns about the majority's reasoning.
Yeah, this concurrence adds a really important layer to the discussion. It brings up a different perspective and points out a potential problem with the majority's logic. Understanding this is crucial if you really want to grasp all the complexities of this case.
Her main argument was that for forbearance to be valid consideration in these situations, there has to be an unspoken, implied promise from the employer that the employee will keep their job for a reasonable time. Without that implied promise, the whole idea of forbearance, of the employer not firing the employee right away, could be seen as meaningless, illusory, like they said before.
Her worry was that if there's no understanding of a reasonable time frame for continued employment, then an employer could technically meet the consideration requirement by keeping the employee on for a very short time, even just a day or two after they sign the non-compete. In her view, this would basically make the consideration meaningless and make the whole restrictive covenant feel like it was forced on the employee, especially since they were threatened with termination.
And this is where it gets really interesting, especially when we think about at-will employment. Chief Justice Aberton said that if we don't require employers to implicitly promise continued employment for a reasonable time after getting a signature on a non-compete, we might start chipping away at the whole idea of at-will employment. The majority, though, argued back that other contract law principles would prevent that from happening.
It all comes down to the core of at-will employment. The traditional understanding is that either the employer or the employee can end the relationship at any time without having to give a reason and without any penalties. What the concurrence is saying is that using the threat of firing someone to get them to sign a restrictive covenant without also implicitly promising to keep them employed for a decent amount of time could undermine this whole concept of at-will employment. It would introduce this element of coercion without any real commitment from the employer's side.
The concurrence even explicitly says that the majority opinion is, quote, in effect holding that Runsheimer implicitly promised not to terminate Freeland's employment for a reasonable time. This really highlights a tension in the legal thinking here, doesn't it? Was there really such an implicit promise? And if so, what would be considered a reasonable amount of time in this type of situation?
Exactly. It boils down to this. How long does the employer have to hold back from firing the employee for the consideration to be real and meaningful? The majority seemed to say that any amount of continued employment after signing would be enough, but the concurrence argued for a more significant amount of time to prevent employers from abusing this power.
So let's break down all this legal stuff into some key takeaways for you as you continue your legal studies. Firstly, when it comes to restrictive covenants in employment contracts, consideration can have a broader meaning. It doesn't always have to be a new job offer or a bonus or something like that. In Wisconsin, at least, the act of an employer choosing not to fire an at-will employee can be enough to meet the legal requirement of consideration.
That's a really important takeaway. Consideration isn't always about the employee getting something concrete. It can also be about the employer giving up something they have the legal right to.
Second, even if there's valid consideration, the restrictive covenant itself still has to be reasonable. What does that mean? Well, the court will look at things like the geographic scope of the restriction, how long it lasts, in this case it was 2 years, and what specific types of work the employee is prevented from doing. Remember, this case was actually sent back to the lower court for them to determine if the terms of the agreement were actually reasonable.
Finding valid consideration, that's just step one for an employer trying to enforce a non-compete. The court can still toss the agreement out if it's too broad or unfairly limits the employee's ability to find another job. This separate analysis of reasonableness is just as important as the consideration issue.
Third takeaway, what the employer does and what their intentions are really matters. Be on the lookout for signs of bad faith. If an employer pressures an employee to sign a non-compete and then turns around and fires them soon after, the court's probably not going to enforce that agreement. The court mentioned fraudulent inducement, which basically means tricking someone into signing something. If the employer never intended to keep the employee on for any reasonable amount of time, they might have tricked the employee into signing.
It all comes down to the context. This idea of good faith and fair dealing, it's a big deal here. If the employer's main goal was to prevent competition and they never plan to actually keep the employee around, a court's going to look very closely at whether that agreement should be enforced.
And finally, whenever possible, negotiate. If your employer asks you to sign a restrictive covenant while you're already working there, don't just assume it's automatically enforceable. You have the right to understand what you're agreeing to and try to negotiate the terms.
This is good advice for anyone, really, especially for future lawyers who will be advising clients. Employees often have more leverage than they think, especially if they've been with the company for a while and are valuable assets. Trying to negotiate things like the scope, how long the restriction lasts, or other terms of the agreement, it's always worth a shot before you sign.
So let's bring it all together. This deep dive into Roenheimer v. Freeland shows us that even when we're talking about at-will employment, restrictive covenants can be backed up by the employer's promise to keep the employee on, at least for some time.
In the end, this case clarified the rules around consideration in Wisconsin when it comes to restrictive covenants signed during an ongoing at-will employment relationship. It lays out a framework for figuring out when an employer's decision not to immediately fire an employee can be used to legally bind that employee to these types of restrictions after they leave the company.
The key point here is that forbearance, the act of not doing something you have the legal right to do, can count as consideration in these specific situations. But remember, the circumstances surrounding the signing and whether the terms of the agreement are reasonable are still crucial factors in determining whether a court will enforce it. The concurring opinion also gave us some food for thought about how this ruling might impact the broader idea of at-will employment.
It highlights this ongoing debate and the tricky balancing act that courts have to do. They have to weigh the need to protect businesses with the need to make sure there's fair competition and that employees have the freedom to pursue their careers. It's not a simple issue.
Here's a final thought to chew on as you continue to learn about employment law. If an employer can threaten to fire someone to get them to sign a restrictive covenant, how much power do at-will employees really have? And what are the ethical implications of this power dynamic in the workplace? This case gives us a good starting point to examine that complex relationship. There's definitely a lot more to explore about finding that balance between protecting businesses and ensuring that employees have real professional freedom.
This case makes you think about the bigger picture, about the impact these agreements have on our society and our economy. Do they encourage innovation and protect legitimate business interests, or do they stifle competition and unfairly limit individual career growth? It's a question worth pondering.